This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G, along with Dr. Lyle, Dr. Doug Lyle. How are you doing, Dr. Lyle?
Good. How about yourself?
Doing pretty good. You know, it's we are here with the radio show every week. Wednesdays, 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'm doing fine, doing great. Really love learning about this kind of stuff. As I said before, I think this should be called revolutionary psychology, as well as evolutionary psychology. But let's just get right down to the questions. We've got a couple of questions today. The first one has to do with nurturing and parenting, and then the second question has to do with millennials. And then we've got one about self-confidence and self-esteem. And, of course, if there's any callers that want to call in, you're going to go right to the front of the line with your question. If you call in, the number is 657-383-0751. All right, so let's take it away here from the first question here. So, dear Dr. Lyle, how important do you think that the nurture element of parenting is in the life outcomes of people, for instance, mental health, wealth, happiness, and relationships? I know you've said before that children are very resilient, but as a parent, how much of what I do can influence their outcomes, maybe through developing close attachments, praising effort, role modeling behavior? And then also, what about the other extreme ends? What impact do absent fathers or maternal rejection, like through adoption, what impact does that have? Many thanks.
Good question. And I've talked about this in other places. Let's separate out a few different. First of all, I'm going to go to the heart of what her question is, but then I want to make sure that I backtrack and that we talk about the fact that the time that the person spends with their parents is in and itself an important time of life, not because of the future, but because of its present. So if you spend 18 or 20 years in very close proximity to somebody, then that's a very important percentage of your life. And it's a percentage of the happiness or unhappiness and the quality of your existence in total has to be partially factored by your first 20 years of life. So whether or not that first 20 years of life has anything to do with the next 60 years of life is an open question and one worth looking at. But let's look at what the evidence tells us, and then we're going to look at some theories and why people's intuition about this is so amazingly poor. The research evidence indicates that you're not going to be shaping these people's personalities basically at all, if any at all. So you have tremendous impact on their days when they are with you, but you don't have a tremendous impact on their futures. So people have a strong intuition that they are shaping their children's habits, their industriousness, their intelligence, their artistic abilities, like, you know, their good habits for schoolwork, et cetera, et cetera. So they have this notion that they're having, that it's critical to have a very heavy hand on the tiller as we guide these little individuals into becoming adults, and this is going to be a large determining factor in the kid's outcome. That will not be true. The way we know that this is not true is by the monozygotic twin adoption studies that were analyzed at the University of Minnesota in the 1980s. So finally, after, 6,000 years of recorded history and speculation on this question, we finally have a definitive answer. So if you were to go in the early 20th century and throughout the most of the 20th century, by far the two dominant paradigms of thinking about personality development, which is the question of how it is that we become individually different from one another. The two paradigms were essentially Freudian and neo-Freudian thinking, which we'll talk about that in a second. And then the other would have been what we're going to call behaviorism or learning theory, also can be characterized as what's called the standard social science model. So those two things put together, those two things essentially waged their own war for most of the 20th century, with there being sort of the deep depth psychology, psychodynamic folks on in one camp, and the sort of more scientifically oriented, academically oriented, experimentally oriented academic psychologist in the other camp, representing learning theory. And so, okay, looks like I'm just going off on this question for a few minutes. All right. So,
yeah, that's all right.
Dynamic people. Yeah, what the heck? It's our show.
It.
We can do what we want.
Yeah.
So the psychodynamic model, as it was first envisioned by Freud, had to do with people going through stages of development where they had this energy, the libido energy, and it's going to the person has to go through certain, essentially, has to deal with certain crises at certain times of their development. So they're going to have to deal with the weaning crisis of getting off the breast. They're going to have to learn how to poop. They're going to discover their genitals. They're going to have to worry about the fact that if they're a little boy, somehow they're in conflict with their father over their mother's love. That's the Oedipal conflict. So these are, in Freud's view, if a person didn't satisfactorily resolve this conflict, then they wound up with characteristic problems in adulthood associated with not having resolved this conflict. Now, this is turns out to be, of course, not true at all, but to tell that to a Freudian even today, and they would just be stunned to hear that kind of rejection, and they would say very confidently, how can you know such a thing? And the reason why they are unaware that this is incorrect is they're unaware of the monozygotic twin adoption data. So in the same vein, and slightly more intellectually aware here, is the people from learning theory. Now, the learning theorists were extremely confident that human beings became what they became, individually different from one another, based on what we're going to call their learning history or their reinforcement or punishment history. And this was first clearly and emphatically stated by the American behaviorist John Watson in 1913 in a famous paper, one of the most cited papers in the history of psychology. It's called Psychology as a Behaviorist Views It. And it essentially tells the story of that we're not really interested in this psychodynamic mumbo-jumbo in effect. What we want to know is the organism's learning history. We want to know what has been the circumstances or the environmental inputs on the organism, because that will tell us why the organism behaves the way it does. Now, this was sensible. Freud's view was very creative and interesting, and he had a reason for sort of believing some of the things that he believed, but the learning model was much more academical. It was fundamentally based on the classical conditioning discoveries of Ian Pavlov, who won the Nobel Prize in Physiology for Medicine in 1905. So Pavlov definitely demonstrated that the brain, let us say that at the end of Pavlov's experiments, a great many psychologists, including those who would become dominant in academic psychology, believed that the brain was an association device. And so 50 years later, a famous psychologist by the name of Donald O'Hebb would quote the famous quote that neurons that fire together, wire together. In other words, which is essentially what Pavlov was demonstrating with classical conditioning, that if you present food to a dog and ring a bell at the same time, and you keep doing that, that sooner or later you can ring the bell and the dog will salivate just as it would salivate when you put the food in front of it. And so, i.e., neurons that fire together, wire together. So you're able to wire the ringing of the bell together with an unconditioned reflex, which is salivation, because you're presenting it with food, which naturally activates the salivation. So this becomes, you know, very confidently, the behaviorists march forward. They get a further boost from the work of B.F. Skinner, who extends Pavlovian conditioning to another important consideration of the way that creatures learn, which is going to be what we call operant conditioning, which is that when you do something, let's suppose you raise your hand in class, and then the teacher calls on you and you answer, and she says, "Oh, that was fantastic." So now you've been what we call reinforced. Or if you are a chicken in a cage and you flutter your left wing and then suddenly a little light goes on that you've learned that there's food if you peck that light, then you're going to flutter your little left feather again sooner than you otherwise would have. And so this means that you do things and then there are consequences, good or bad, depending upon what you've done. Now, you see how this is fundamentally different from Pavlov, where in Pavlov, the dog didn't do anything. It's sitting there, and we bring the food, and now it has an unconditioned reflex that it can't stop itself, that it's designed by nature to start to salivate, to get ready to deal with the food, and now we ring the bell at the same time, and the brain fires and wires this together, and the organism, in other words, there's certain conditions upon which the organism will salivate, and if we control those conditions, we have, quote, conditioned the organism. Okay, so this is Pavlov's view. Skinner now adds something else, which is that we can wait for the organism to do something, and then when it does it, we either reinforce it or punish it. We either reward it or we punish it. And in doing so, yes, go ahead.
It's going to sound like I'm trying to make a joke. I actually am not.
Yeah.
So is the example you gave with the chicken, you know, flapping its wing and then pecking the light, is that similar to nowadays, like someone is doing like a superstition where they're like, oh, you know, I put my wrong sock on before a hockey game and I ended up winning that game, so therefore I'm going to put the wrong sock on every game?
No question. In fact, this is what B.F. Skinner, he actually called it superstitious behavior.
Okay.
So he had believed he had arrived at an explanation as to why, you know, the Native Americans did rain dances. And so this is he's basically saying, look, this is what it is. The they start dancing around, and one day they're dancing around and it rained. And so now they're dancing around and they're going to keep dancing around, and then it rains. So they dance and dance and dance until it rains. And so as a result of that, the system is being rewarded by this behavior, and it's being reinforced. And if behavior is being reinforced, then what's going to happen is the mind, like a computer, is essentially calculating that it's a good thing to do that in order to get rewards. And so it's going to emit, or it's going to generate that behavior statistically more often than alternative behaviors. And so the behaviorist says, listen, if you want to understand why an organism is doing what it's doing, what you need to understand is you need to understand its learning history. And I can prove to you that the learning history is the variable that is causing the outcome that you're seeing, because if I put that animal in a cage and I reinforce it every time it lifts its left feather, then I can – I don't know when for sure it's going to lift its left feather, but I guarantee you in the next 24 hours, if we watch it, it will lift its left feather far more times than it's going to lift its right feather. And that's because we've reinforced it. And then if you want to change it up, all I have to do is I have to reinforce it for lifting the right feather and not reinforce it for the left feather. And we come back in 3 days and it'll be lifting the right feather. And so since this is true, by the way, and the behaviorists got very good at training animals to do these things, they could trade an animal to seemingly do just about anything that you can imagine. And so as a result of that, they said, listen, if you're trying to understand why one animal of a species is behaving differently than another animal of that species, the thing to look for is how it is, its behaviors have been reinforced and punished. Now, this is elegant, simple, reasonable, demonstrable at the level of the animals in the animal cages. So as a result, you can imagine that the behaviorists were extremely confident that this was, in fact, the reason for individual differences in behavior. Now, I'm going to add a few other things to this, and that is that when you observe humans, you're going to observe two other things that are striking. Number one, if you've got a big, strong, muscular dad out in the yard with a shovel, digging up the yard industriously on Saturday morning, and you've got two young, strapping sons, also strong, little strong kids, and they, too, are digging up the yard right alongside their dad joyously with their little shovels. You look at this and you say, ah, well, they're learning to be industrious little shovelers by watching their dad. And you can say, well, obviously, from the time they're tiny kids, we see them imitating. So they're imitating like crazy. And so human children have a phenomenal, I mean, human beings have a tremendous amount of what we're going to call mirror neurons, where they can very quickly imitate movements that you will do. This is these are adaptive instincts inside of human beings that we have a genetically coded ability and affinity for copying what other people are doing when we're young. And so as a result of this, people have observed the extraordinary copying that little children will do. And they will also observe as time goes on that the children are very similar in their characteristics and their behaviors to the parents. Or sometimes it's stunning how much they're alike. Sometimes they're not so much alike. But they very often are alike. In fact, they are more alike those parents than they are like anybody else on their street. And not only that, they look like their parents more than they look like anybody else on the street. Or at least the wife hopes so. So at any rate.
Almost like there's a genetic connection.
Right. So as a result of this, human beings, just with their own eyeballs, watching these contingencies, and also the behaviorists who are just regular old people that are watching this imitation and looking at the contingency between fathers and sons and mothers and daughters, et cetera, and then they know from the laboratory about just how much phenomenal control they can exert over the behavior of laboratory animals by influencing their reinforcement and punishment history. They basically felt like there really wasn't an argument. They didn't consider that there really was any other argument. And then something else, they essentially did not consider that there was another argument. And the Freudian model, which was an oddball model of, you know, we've got these developmental stages, and then there's some kind of conflict with the individual, you know, intrapsychic conflict, and then it's played out with what we're going to ultimately call, these significant others, or what we call object relations, which means the relationship between the individual and these very significant others in their life, i.e. mothers or surrogate mothers or fathers or surrogate fathers, you know, et cetera, that these dynamics, that a person might be, you know, very neat and orderly because there's mothers very neat and orderly and they want to seek their mother's love and their mother was good to them and they had a good bond, or it may turn out that they became unbelievably sloppy in a reaction to the fact that their mother was rejecting or whatever the hell. In other words, the Freudian model could explain anything, because if it went opposite to what you would think, Then they said, oh, it's a reaction against. And if it went towards it, you'd say, oh, well, that's with it. And so it was a very flexible model, but essentially it's like the post Monday morning quarterbacking of an NFL thing. Like, well, had we kicked the field goal there, then, you know, this or that would have happened. So this is the scientific community takes one look at the psychodynamic explanation and says, forget it, guys. You don't have a science. You don't have any falsifiable hypotheses. You don't have a hypothesis that you can tell me what you expect to happen, because you're telling me anything could happen. You know, the kid could be more neat and orderly. He could be obedient. If it goes the other way, he could become defiant. So, you know, hey, you've got nothing there. And they actually called it Jewish science. They basically said, listen, this is Freud and his Jewish buddies, and forget it. You know, we don't believe in this. This is bogus. There is no scientific observation. There is no intent to try to make falsifiable predictions. This is not science. And the behaviorists went straight forward with their own investigations for decades. And I have to tell you that these investigations were very interesting. Many discoveries were made, many insights in the nature of essentially the way the animal nervous system works in terms of its memory function, essentially how many times you have to ring the bell after you don't present the food in order for the conditioned reflex of salivating to the bell, how long until it goes away. So they're plotting on a graph, they're plotting extinction curves, they're plotting learning curves, which is a word that is now throughout the language. That the concept of the learning curve came from the behaviorists. That's who invented that concept, and that they plotted those things to show how animals would learn at what speed under different conditions. So you can imagine, for example, how interesting it would be if you're an early behaviorist to say, listen, what if we reinforce that guy and he fluffs his feathers every other time, not every time? Let's see what happens then. Let's plot the learning curve and see how fast he learns and see how often we get that the left feather fluttering. What if it's every third time? Okay. And then B.F. Skinner one day basically by accident said, what if it's random? Okay. What if we reinforce it sometimes and then not others and then three times in a row, et cetera, et cetera. And so if we do that, it turns out if you have what's called a variable interval reinforcement schedule, that turns out to be the schedule that has the slowest extinction curve. And this makes sense. So an organism that is reinforced every time that you want it to do something, then when you stop doing it, it catches on. The brain says, hey, wait a second, it looks like this contingency is gone. If you do it every third time, it's going to have a little slower extension curve when you stop reinforcing it, because it might be thinking by the time you hit three and it's expecting reinforcement, it might say, well, something's a little haywire, we're going to wait to four. Something's a little haywire, we're going to wait to five. You know what? We're going to wait to six. And it might be until 12 that it finally gives up and quits having the response. But you can imagine if it reinforced on trials one and two, and then not three, four, five, and then it's reinforced on six, and then not reinforced for seven and eight, and then it's reinforced 9, 10, 11, 12 in a row, and then it's not reinforced for five in a row. The organism is essentially learning there's reinforcements here, but we can't predict it. So therefore, on trial 20, which is the last time that you reinforce it, if you then go no reinforcement, no reinforcement, no reinforcement, no reinforcement, you might go 15 trials and you're still getting an effect, because that thing is still thinking that it might get reinforced effectively. So, and Skinner would say it's not thinking anything. It doesn't have any conscious designs on what you're up to. This is a machine that is effectively trying to model and predict the future, and it's got little algorithms in there, and these algorithms are a little bit different depending upon what the nature of the reinforcement pattern is that it's seeing. This makes perfect sense, and it's actually quite brilliant. And incidentally,
this
these
is like gambling,
the way
right?
Totally. It's exactly how gambling machines are built. Gambling machines are built with very careful attention to detail about human beings in order to figure out how to optimize or essentially how to reduce the extinction curve for, in other words, how much money can you take out of their pocket before they quit playing? So that's exactly how Las Vegas is built. So the so now you look at the situation and you say, okay, well, how on earth could that not be true? So the great scientists of the 20th century in psychology reject the Freudian psychodynamic model. It's an unfalsifiable set of hypotheses that actually aren't making a lot of sense, and there's no fundamental grounding of any observations that are systematic. And they go right ahead and forge their way through looking at the brain as this sort of adaptive machine that is looking for payoffs, which makes a great deal of sense, makes sense to this day. And so as a result, they find things. So they find all kinds of things about how this thing works, and they can demonstrate it in the laboratory, and they'll tell you, listen, of course we can't tell you what Harry the Rat's going to do out there in, you know, running around your barn, because we don't know his reinforcement history. But if we did know his reinforcement history, we could tell you. Of course you would be that confident. Now, it turns out they were wrong. And there's no way they saw this coming. Okay, so they were completely caught with their pants down. And rightfully so. I mean, this is how science evolves. This is how human beings come to know great things about the nature of, you know, themselves and their universe, is that people keep looking at different angles and looking at alternative hypotheses, and then, you know, one day they started figuring out that they should test them. And so that's, you know, the dawn of science. I mean, science can essentially be encapsulated as a set of activities that use systematic observations in order to essentially challenge alternative hypotheses. And so you're trying to figure out at the root of whether or not you can prove yourself wrong. And, you know, that's the highest road of science, is this is what I think is true. Let me see, be as imaginative, as brilliant as I can, to try to set up a set of experiments to try to prove myself wrong. And can I prove myself wrong? And so my hat's off to the world of 20th century psychology in the academic tradition, because they tried to do that. Now, in 1985, they'd proved themselves wrong. So it turns out that Abe Telligen and Robert Plowman and Sandra Scar and all these giants of late 20th century behavior genetics, this was coming on the heels of some very interesting work that had been done earlier. The notion of trying to figure out the question that this lady started with, which is personality and parenting and how much it matters and all this sort of thing, like where do you come from and why are you the way you are? And can you influence who your child becomes by how it is that essentially you reinforce and punish and model how to behave? So this is a great question, and it's an important question. And so the answer to the question, there was an alternative hypothesis that wasn't being considered by academic psychology. And the alternative hypothesis was, is the variation that you're looking at between people genetic in origin? And I have to tell you, folks, you know, when I was doing my undergraduate, that wasn't even considered. That was not even, that was in no textbook that I have any exposure to. And then when I was a grad student, it still wasn't in any textbook. In other words, this was not considered at all. I think there was the beginnings of it, is that it might be involved, genetic variation might be involved in psychopathology. So in other words, somebody, quote, might have a bad gene that might cause them to have some very unusual problem, i.e., in the arena of very disturbing psychiatric dysfunction, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, alcoholism. Okay, these sorts of things. People were more biologically oriented. Psychologists were looking at this, and they were starting to sniff around and starting to see whether or not there was any evidence that genes might play a role. Well, it turns out that the first, I believe the first investigations in this, I think there was a guy named Cyril Burt, who's a famous behavior geneticist, that was apparently caught faking his data years later. Now, it turns out I don't believe he was faking his data. I think he actually made an honest mistake. But when that mistake was pointed out, that his data was too neat, then everybody rained hell on the notion of behavior genetics, and it sort of set back the cachet of behavior genetics for some time. But meanwhile, there was other people like Irving Gottesman and Sir James Shields in England who were looking at schizophrenia, and they were tracking down twins that had been separated at birth, and they were tracking down twins, also identical twins versus fraternal twins, and they were checking to see what was happening to these people. If one of the twin was schizophrenic, what was the deal with the co-twin? And Gottesman and Shields were demonstrating, after a lot of painful effort, they were figuring out that the monozygotic twins were an awful lot more likely. In other words, if one co-twin was schizophrenic and they were identicals, then the odds that the other one was schizophrenic was very high. It was 50 or 60%. And if the one co-twin was schizophrenic and the other one was a fraternal twin, then I believe the odds were down in the nature of maybe 5% or so. I can't remember what it was. It was a huge difference. And so publishing this was not so disturbing to the general grand scheme of learning theory. So the learning theorists weren't even looking sideways when Gottesman and Shields were publishing. They're sort of shrugging their shoulders and like, well, okay, well, if you got something really bizarre and really haywire, you know, I guess we could understand that that's not normal psychology, therefore it doesn't surprise us. So that's fine. That didn't threaten anybody. And it was through that side door of looking at what they were finding in extreme pathology, bit by bit, it started to be acceptable to start to consider the idea that genetic variation might be serious business. And so it wasn't until the mid-80s, using the Minnesota Twin Registry, that they were able to track down a large number of identical twins who had been raised apart. And they were able to compare these to identical twins who had been raised together by their biological parents. And so this now sets up nature's perfect experiment, that you are holding the genes constant. In other words, we've got exactly the same genes sitting in two different bodies, being raised by two different parents, and then we have exactly the same set of genes being raised by the same household, by the same parents. So if the environment has a substantial impact on personality development, we should see that the kids who are raised in the same household should be much more alike than the kids that are raised in different households, number one. And number two, it should also be the case that identical twins, for example, shouldn't be much more alike than fraternal twins. If the environment is guiding the show, then you could see what the learning theory hypothesis would be. The learning theory hypothesis would be that, you know, obviously you would like to use twins and you'd like to have both the same sex, and you like them because now they're born on the same day, so their parents' socioeconomic situation remains exactly the same for the two people. So we're not looking at people that were born at slightly different times. So we've got a pair of, for example, fraternal twins who share half of their genes, and those people shouldn't be any more alike if we take, say, 50 sets of those people. Those people raised by the same parents, those kids shouldn't be any more or less alike than 50 pairs of monozygotic twins that are raised by their parents. And it should certainly be the case that if we have a pair of monozygotic or identical twins, that's what we mean by that, identicals, excuse me, if we take a pair of identical twins and they are raised by different people, then it should certainly, by different families because they're adopted out, it should certainly be the case that the identicals being adopted out should not be anywhere close to as similar as a pair of fraternals who are being raised and nurtured by exactly the same parents. In other words, they're in the same household, same clothes, same mom, same dad, same school, same church, same socioeconomic status, same everything. Well, it turns out it's not even close, folks. So it's going to turn out that the monozygotics raised apart are vastly more similar than the fraternals that are raised in the same house. It's not even close. Mm-hmm. So, and it turns out that whether the monozygotic or identicals are raised together or they are raised apart makes almost no difference. They are extremely similar. So now we have the answer to the question of the ages, which is, how much difference does it make? And the answer is not much. Okay, now. So now we go back to, this is not meant to trash parenting at all. And it's also not meant to say that parenting can't make a difference in outcomes. So certainly you can imagine that a child that has an encouraging and supportive parent who recognizes that the kid has some hurdles and does things to get the kid assistance and make sure that we open up opportunities, of course that individual has a better odds of, you know, winding up with better outcomes than someone who has a parent who is thwarting them and considering the kid a burden, et cetera, in all likelihood. Unless you talk to a psychodynamic theorist who would say, well, maybe you react against all that obstacle and maybe you become more successful. So the point is that we got a problem predicting things, and it turns out you can't predict things very well by trying to look at the learning history and the situation that the person finds themselves in. Now, but at the end of the day, I think that we want to use some reasonable judgment that we would use in looking at the actions and behavior of any people around us, if we're managing them or we're in a romantic relationship with them or we're their friends with them, that, of course, being supportive and encouraging is going to be useful, and it's going to improve people's willingness to take chances. It's going to help them build their confidence, et cetera, et cetera. So can you make a difference in the process of a person's development in terms of how much they enjoy their life and possibly the opportunities and doors that they open for themselves later? Of course you can. How big a difference is it going to make in terms of anything measurable that you're going to see? Pretty hard to find it. It's not easy to find it, but that doesn't mean it's not there, and it doesn't mean that psychologists have always been necessarily looking in exactly the right place. But if you wanted to predict, for example, how much money people are going to make, don't be looking about, you know, what school their dad had them in and how many tutors they had. Just show me their identical co-twin that they've never met. Just, you know, turns out they've got an identical co-twin in Seattle right now that they haven't seen in 36 years since the day they were born. And if I go find that co-twin and I find out how much money that co-twin's making, that's going to be the best guess I'm going to have as to what this guy's making. It's not going to be how nurturing his mom was. It's not going to be how hard she pushed him. It's not going to be how much their dad encouraged them. It's not going to have anything to do with their learning history to speak of. I mean, it may a little bit. But the biggest factor is going to be, what's his co-twin doing? I.e., what set of genes does he have that are part and parcel of who it is that he is? And he finds himself in the environment known as the United States. That environment is fairly equivalent across the United States, and Western Europe for that matter, in most places. And so we throw those genes at the world, and those genes need to figure out how on earth they can optimize their survival and reproductive success. And those genes will find their ecological niche, and they will find places where it is that they have advantages over competitors, and they'll find places where they have relative weaknesses. And they will do what Sandra Scar calls genetic niche picking. They will figure out where it is that they are best suited, and they will head for those places naturally. And so this is the big part of the story. So I'm, you know, people will say, oh my God, you know, I'm doing all this work for what? You know, I mean, with these kids. And the answer is, you're doing this work because, number one, there's a lot of things that need to take place in childhood. Just in general, there's a process of learning and development that goes on naturally, and you got to be there for it and wipe their nose. The second thing is, however, don't be fretting and worried about shaping them in some way. You won't do it. I've seen kids that were very clearly pretty cold-hearted little SOBs, and I've seen mothers banging their heads against the wall trying to get the kid to see empathically why they should be nicer to other kids. That's a total waste of breath. Okay, that is not possible. So you are not going to teach a child to be empathic. They are either empathic or they are not. You have parents who are trying to cram information in their kids, trying to make them smarter with baby Einstein and everything else under the sun. That is a total fiasco, and it will blow up right in your face. That's not going to amount to anything. So what I suggest to parents is be with your children like you would be with anybody else. Be kind, be warm, be supportive, be firm when you need to be, set reasonable limits. You are living in a space with conflicts of interest between you and that child, and they can learn that there are such conflicts of interest and there are boundaries to the limits of your altruism. Don't let them run your existence. Enjoy your life as much as you can with the responsibilities and sacrifices that you need to make. Do a good job trying to aid and abet their existence. Don't think that every disappointment and frustration that they have because they didn't get everything they wanted somehow bruises their psyche and will make them resent you. It will not, okay? Not unless they've got a genetic chip in them to be disagreeable and entitled in the first place, at which point there's nothing that you're going to do that's going to help that. So the point is to treat them kindly and warmly and lovingly, just the way you would any pet, okay? So I don't try to take my pets and try to change their personalities. My pets, I've got two cats, they have very different personalities, and I do not try to change them. I love those cats in the way that they are. I enjoy greatly their individual differences. I laugh at my ability to predict which one is going to do what. I know which one is waking me up at what time of the day, and I know how they're waking me up. Okay, I know their different voices and their sounds. I can hear the differences in their emotional expressions. That's how people are. And we didn't shape them to be that way. They just are. All right, so that's question number one. Oh, sorry about that. I thought that was going to be a quick one.
Well, I had just to say, Dr. Lyle.
Because folks didn't know. Nate told me today, oh, we only have two questions. I'm like, uh-oh, what are we going to do?
Well, I really have to say, and I've said this before in a previous podcast where I did a little intro when you did your interview with Andrew Taylor from SpudFit, that one of the first times I heard you talk, it was when a patient asked you, "What's love?" And I remember that because, you know, most people who are up speaking for whatever reason, someone will ask them a question. And they'll be like, "Oh, what's love? Oh, yeah, it's just when people care about each other." But no, like you went on for, I think, an hour and a half that night about love and explained every little nitty-gritty detail. And, of course, with someone with as little success as I have with love, it was really interesting for me. So I
me too, which is why I've studied it carefully. You got it.
But it was just cool because every little detail, you know, you ask a question and you don't just get a little simple answer. It's like if we pay attention, we're basically getting gold here. And so, you know, I really appreciate it. And, you know, it's not just me. We get listener emails and I read the questions. But before the questions actually come into play, the people will actually write paragraphs of, you know, thank you for expanding and everything like that. So really appreciate it, Dr. Lai. These are great, great answers.
Very cool. Well, maybe that's it.
All right.
Do we want to do one more quick one? Do we have something that could be quick? Give it a shot. Let's find out what it is.
Yeah, let's do one quick one, then we'll go over the self-esteem and self-confidence next week. Listeners are curious about some of the operant conditioning and reinforcements and like that. We actually had a behavioral therapist call into the show on episode 47 and have a little bit of a question and answer with Dr. Lyle. So feel free to check that out. There's some good information there about how Dr. Lyle explains it to this behavioral therapist. Okay, so our next question. This is from a listener who has an 18-year-old son, and she went house hunting with a real estate agent. And the real estate agent observed the behavior of the son and he basically called him a millennial. And so the listener says this, is labeling generations real? I grew up in the 1980s, and I was pretty stereotypical of that label for that time period. But it doesn't really seem that much different from the description of today's youth. Isn't every generation just exhibiting the same old behaviors of wanting to be the most important person in the village? Or are there legitimate factors making millennials unique enough to give them a new label?
That's a really interesting question. And obviously, we would say that the following would be true. So we just talked about how personalities are going to be genetic. And so you're going to see the same personality variances generation after generation after generation. So, you know, nothing has changed in half a million years. It's the same people. The genes keep getting recycled. They just look a little bit different and they act a little bit different. And every single one of them is unique because it's a unique combination. But believe me, there have been people that were a lot like you that have walked this planet before. And there's some people that are a lot like you that are walking this planet now. Now, they're not you, but they're a lot like you. And most people are not like you. So most people, almost everybody you meet, is substantially different from you on one or more, and usually several, of the big five plus intelligence characteristics. So the notion that, quote, the millennials have all been reinforced or punishment in some specific way in order to stamp them with a, quote, personality style that would be characteristic of a generation is absurd. Of course, that's not true. Now, that being the case, let's talk about some reasons why some people might even think of this in a certain way. Each you could call it a generation. I'm not even sure what a millennial means. If you're born in 95, what about 2005? You know, what about 1998, et cetera? So we're talking about sort of a general thing if you want to market arbitrarily to people that are like 18 or 20 now versus people that are 40 or 30 or whatever. So let's just talk about a 20-year-old now. And that 20-year-old has had a somewhat different life experience than someone who was born in 1970. And somewhat different. So they've had somewhat different cultural events have taken place. There's been maybe different worries and different considerations. But really, they look pretty similar most of the time. So really what a millennial is at this point is it's a young person, for God's sakes. It's a young person who has significant conflicts of interest with their parents and adults over how it is that they want to be using their time, sort of like you and I had when we were that age. So it's going to turn out that when people get to be a certain age, i.e. late teens, they start to have very significant conflicts of interest between them and the adults around them. And as a result, they're about ready to move about 100 yards down the river and starting to fend for themselves, starting to call their own shots, but not too far from mom, just in case they get into hot water. So this is why it's difficult for, you know, 16, 17, 18, 19-year-old young people to live under their parents' roof. Now, it may be true that we've got a bunch of agreeable people and we don't have a problem, but don't count on it. If we have a normal distribution of personality under one roof, somewhere around the mean, then there's a certain amount of disagreeability in there, and there are definitely conflicts of interest. And so the kids went from being sweet little pets whose, when they were little kids, they were unbelievably cute, and their survival and your interests and their interests were essentially perfectly parallel as a parent. When it turns out that they're 15 years old, their interests and your interests are no longer parallel. They are now little reproduction machines, and what they care about is how much status and cachet they can get in the sexual dynamics world. So you're thinking, wait a minute, what happened to my little kid? And aren't you my buddy, and aren't we all going to toodle around town and do our errands together and be happy? And the answer is, no, we're not. I'm going to make you miserable. So as a result of this, these are natural conflicts that are taking place. And it's also true that There's also a weaning conflict, as anticipated by Trivers, that there's a weaning conflict between parent and offspring where there's long-term provisioning of offspring, where the offspring want the resources longer than the parents want to give it to them. And so the genes literally have a mathematical conflict here, as it's in the parent's best interest to move on from provisioning and to produce more babies, i.e. it's about time for the parents to kick the kids out and start having sex again maybe while there's some steam left. But instead,
that explains a lot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. So it turns out that the kids are like, no, I need some more money for this, and I need this, and I need that, and I need the other. And dad is thinking, you know what? I've still got some energy for having sex with your mother, and I'd like to take her to, you know, the Bahamas. And no, oh, but Junior needs this, and Junior needs that. And so Junior, just like a nice, you know, I don't know, little raven, tiny little raven, has his mouth wide open, dominating the nest.
Mom doesn't mind.
Mom's, you know, saying, George, we got to provision Junior here. You know what I mean? He's just got to have more meat. So go kill some more things and throw it down his throat, because this is really important. And so this is the, these are the conflicts that go inside the households of modern America. So we roll our eyes and call them millennials, but they've always been called something, and they've always been a wonderful and exciting pain in the ass. And that's how it is.
Very good. I think we'll end there. I love
Very
it.
Good.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.